These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Coming up on this episode, what did he do? What was he accused of doing?
Well, it's crazy. You want to enter Crazy Town now?
Let's enter Crazy Town. Let's go there.
The officer came to serve the warrant. It's disputed whether he was allowed to come in or whether he came in by himself.
I mean, if you had been treated in this way, would you have said the system works?
No, I don't think I would have. This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections. Hosted by your two favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own ideas and thoughts about just what gives these works the narrative edge. All right, Peter, so back in June, you brought us the story of a Georgia man whose case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and made history.
Mm-hmm. Angelo Herndon's case, chronicled in Brad Snyder's book, You Can't Kill a Man Because of the Books He Reads.
Well, today we're going to talk about another Georgia man's case whose case went to the Supreme Court. And it's another ordinary man who wasn't looking for fame, he wasn't looking for attention, but he became a folk hero. And the book is called The Many Passions of Michael Hardwick, Sex and the Supreme Court in the Age of AIDS by Martin Paget.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing Michael Hardwick, like Angelo Herndon, was arrested and didn't want to be arrested.
Oh, no, definitely didn't want to be arrested. This was a case about his privacy, his right to be intimate with his sexual partner in his own home, free of government interference.
A right we take for granted now.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about sodomy in this case, and sodomy has a lot of meanings, but in the law, it means oral or anal sex. And what year, Peter, do you think it became an established constitutional right in every state for you to have oral or anal sex in the privacy of your own home with a consenting adult, not harming anyone else?
This sounds like a trick question, right? It sounds like it should be years ago, but it might be never, right? Like, are there still states that have this on the books?
I'll give you a five-year window.
Oh, come on. All right, 1985.
No, 2003.
I was very wrong.
2003,
okay.
A case
that's
called...
That's still way too recent, though.
Just 20 years ago, a little more than that. Lawrence v. Texas was the case.
Hmm, wow. So what's the case we're talking about here that involves Michael Hardwick?
So the case we're talking about here is Bowers versus Hardwick from 1986. And the protagonist in our story, Michael Hardwick, in his case lost. And his right to privacy was not affirmed.
Hmm. So he lost, but we still ended up somehow with that right to privacy. I'm curious how that turned out. So tell us how Michael Hardwick was arrested, and how did this case get to the Supreme Court?
Well, first of all, what I love about this book is that it's not just about the Supreme Court case. It's about the man. It's a biography, first and foremost. So we start with Michael Hardwick. Who was he? He was born in Miami in 1954. He came out in the 70s, and his coming out was easy. His parents accepted him. He had no college education, so he became a landscaper. He held a bunch of odd jobs. He moved around a lot, Gainesville, Florida, Atlanta, Fort Lauderdale, North Carolina. But around about 1980, I think, he settled in Atlanta.
What brought him here?
Well, Atlanta is the gay mecca of the South.
Mm, okay.
So just a magnet that scoops up all of the gays from the entire region. Something I found out about myself in 2020 when I found myself without a job and without a partner in 2020 when my relationship ended and my job in tourism ended with the pandemic. You come to the place where there are jobs and other gay people.
Community, right? You find community here.
So that's why I came to Atlanta in 21, and within 8 months I had a job, this job, and within a year and a half I had a partner, my current partner. So that magnet brought Michael to Atlanta, and he became a bartender, very good looking, according to the book, and he had friends, he had a community, he had a bachelor pad on Ponce de Leon Avenue, which still exists, by the way.
The place where he lives still exists?
Yeah, the house where he used to live, where this event that we're going to talk about, it still exists. I found out about it when I first moved here, and I took a gay history tour of Atlanta.
Okay.
And they took us by this house.
So for people who aren't familiar with Ponce de Leon Avenue, like it's a happening place now. There's lots going on, bars and restaurants and whatnot. Was it like that when he moved in?
It was a neighborhood. We're talking Ponce de Leon Place, which is sort of in the area around that area, you know, so where those houses are. He was just doing his thing, living his life.
Mm-hmm.
And working at a bar called The Cove. And one day in 1982, he was coming home from The Cove, and he found himself on the wrong end of the law.
What did he do? What was he accused of doing?
Well, it's crazy. Do you want to enter Crazy Town now?
Let's enter Crazy Town. Let's go there.
The events are just ridiculous to think about. He was coming home from work, had a beer in his hand, and he saw a cop, police car, drive by him. And he knew he's not supposed to have a beer can in his hand, right? So he throws the beer can away. The officer turns around, confronts him, says, "I saw you with a beer can." And of course, now there's no beer can. So sort of a disagreement ensues over whether—
What do you mean? What beer can?
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So eventually, Michael tells the officer, an officer named Keith Torek, "You know what? Just give me a ticket. Just give me a ticket and I'll go away." So on the ticket, the date was circled wrong. And so Michael thought the court date was Wednesday, but it was actually Tuesday. He was going to fight this ticket. So he did not show up for his court date on Tuesday. Torek, he paid his fine, by the way. He paid his fine. Court clerk says, "You're okay. Here's a receipt, says you've paid your fine." Torek, meanwhile, immediately goes to his house to place him under arrest for not showing up for court. Okay. By the way, the book is kind of pretty clear here that this is like harassment over a beer can, right?
Yeah. So I was going to say, this seems like a really minor thing for the police to deal with. At least it would be today when there's so many other things going on. Did the officer have some kind of indication that Hardwick was gay and because of that he was picking on him?
We don't know, but that's what the speculation is in the book. So anyways, Torek, the officer, goes to the home. Michael's not there, comes back. And eventually, Torek enters the house, sort of unclear whether or not he had the permission to enter.
Like the door was cracked maybe?
Mm-hmm. And so he catches Michael and another partner in the act.
On August 3rd, Michael had come back to his apartment from work, had brought a friend home with him, was in his bedroom. The officer came to serve the warrant and got access to the house. It's disputed whether he was allowed to come in or whether he came in by himself. And went back to Michael's bedroom where he found him with another man. And according to Georgia law, that could carry a penalty of up to 20 years in jail.
20 years, Peter.
Wow. That's absurd.
Can you imagine?
That's absolutely absurd.
What would you do? Someone just barged in on you like that.
I mean, freak out. I would absolutely freak out. And after that, who knows? I'd probably blank out from panic.
Well, he was arrested, charged with sodomy, handcuffed, booked, humiliated in jail, eventually bonded out by his friend, and everybody just wanted this to go away. But you know what? He became angry, and he just became angry about it. And I think that's what a lot of people would do in that case. And at some point, civil rights lawyers get involved.
And what did his lawyers have to say?
So his lawyers encouraged him to fight, basically saying this is the perfect case to challenge sodomy laws.
Really? What made it perfect?
Well, usually sodomy was charged in connection with something else. So in other words, you were charged with having sex in a public place and sodomy, or you were charged with sexual assault and sodomy. But in this case, he was just charged with sodomy. And sodomy meant you were illegal, right? So sodomy meant that you couldn't have a job in, you know, the military or a teacher. Mm. Sodomy was the basis for an entire system of laws and situations that made gay people second-class citizens.
It was on its face, discriminatory, and that's why it was perfect.
Yeah,
it
so
was...
the lawyers said, fight it.
Fight it, okay. And so he did.
Yeah, and there were legal arguments at the time that came before. You know, this was Roe versus Wade had happened already. So we had privacy cases that the lawyers thought boded well for Michael in court. They were arguing government overreach. They said this is the epitome of government overreach. The government coming into your bedroom and policing you. And critically, the lawyers did not want to make it an equal protection case.
Why not? Why go the privacy route and not equal protection?
Well, equal protection, if they had argued equal protection, they were basically saying that there's a constitutional right to be gay. But they were saying, no, privacy is well established, and this is everybody, okay? Don't forget, sodomy wasn't just gay. Everybody's yep. doing it. It's man, woman, everybody. And they're saying that the Constitution lets people be left alone in the privacy of their own house. So they thought it was a good argument.
And what did the lower courts think of that argument?
So the lower courts actually sided with him. They sided with him. And so when it was appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, lawyers, again, thought they had a good shot.
The 11th Circuit decided that Michael's rights to privacy had been violated. And that decision came out of the 11th Circuit the year before the Supreme Court decided to choose the case to hear it. And unfortunately, when they did hear it, there was a vote that was in Michael's favor, 5-4, with Justice Powell agreeing with the rest of the jurists who said that his right to privacy had been violated. But then the Supreme Court's Chief Justice Warren Burger convinced him to change his vote. And then Harry Blackmun's opinion became a dissent, and the case became what we know it as today.
So that decision was 1986.
Wow, and he lost by one vote.
He lost by one vote, and in the book, it's described how Powell later said that that was the one decision in his entire career that he regretted the most. It has gone down as one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history, if you're liberal, obviously, sort of like the gay version of Plessy v. Ferguson.
Hmm. So does this book chronicle Powell's thinking on that, like why he switched to the conservative side?
Yep. So there were memos. So there was a lot of paper trail as to what Powell thought. Powell thought that this was a gay rights case, not a privacy case. He thought this was sort of a Trojan horse, that he was skeptical that it was a privacy case. He thought it was basically an equal protection case by stealth, and he thought it was a manufactured case, basically. But the book notes that Powell's memos were riddled with prejudice. He used words like deviant. Powell was genuinely disgusted by gay people.
Huh.
And he asked, you know, if we allow sodomy, will that allow bigamy and incest and prostitution? It's sort of, that's the line of thinking back then. And well, and by the way, this was the age of AIDS, right? Which mm-hmm. is in the title here. So the book also goes into, you know, just how it was considered a plague at that time to be gay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the hand of God coming down to punish those.
Yeah, so this was all in the mix at the time, and the Supreme Court just didn't agree with it.
Yeah, well, it makes sense that you say that he had some inherent homophobia, because I mean, so what if it was an equal protection case by stealth? I mean, look at the facts, right? But he had his prejudice, and that's what he chose. But eventually, he had a turnaround moment later in life when it didn't really matter.
sounds like he was very flippy-floppy on this.
Yeah, okay. Well, where did all this leave Michael Hardwick?
Well, keep in mind now this is 4 years after the incident. Michael, by this time, had become sort of a folk hero in the LGBTQ movement. He was on TV shows. He spoke at rallies. He was on the cover of magazines. But he had moved on for the most part. He moved to Fort Lauderdale, Miami Beach. He became a bartender in high-end nightclubs.
So he didn't go to jail for sodomy?
No, no. He was booked and arrested, and he was in jail that time, but...
He didn't serve hard time then?
No.
Okay, so he ended up being a bartender, sorry, you were saying?
Well, he was very good at what he did, which was just being around people in a ebullient face, serving them, but he also was a gifted artist, and this is what I also liked about the book, learning about his art.
Miami Beach was pulling itself out of the ultra-crime wave from the very early 1980s. Lots of spaces were being reclaimed and turned into queer-friendly clubs or just, you know, playing queer clubs. And Michael found his niche, and he started to produce this massive-scale art. He had found a studio place in Miami Beach that was dirt cheap to rent, and he could build statues 16 feet tall and had help doing them. He, in essence, I think, was trying to recast memories from his early adulthood and his childhood. Some of the things that he sculpted and put into these places, he made a lizard that stood over a bar they called the Lizard Lounge over in Fort Lauderdale at Squeeze. His sister had made them lounge lizard costumes when they were 8 and 12 years old.
That sounds really cool. Is there a picture of this lizard statue in the book? I really want to see this now.
No, there's no pictures of the lizard statue, but there's some pictures of some of his other art. I mean, and it's amazing what it... At least from the descriptions, I think you could call him a sculptor, but I think probably set designer would be a better word for it. He would take these nightclubs and make these massive floor-to-ceiling installations, caterpillars, giant caterpillars, aliens, angels. But he returned to private life, and he did few interviews. And Michael was interviewed by the legendary PBS host, Bill Moyers.
I know that the system works. And when I set out to do this, I never necessarily thought I was going to go to the Supreme Court. And I definitely didn't think I was going to lose at the Supreme Court. But I always had in the back of my mind that what I was setting out to do was to try to change the law. Not necessarily to change it, though, even if I could just lay a foundation for future change.
When I found that clip, I was surprised. I mean, if you had been treated in this way, would you have said the system works?
No, I don't think I would have. But eventually it did kind of sort itself out. I mean, we spoke at the beginning about how those sodomy laws no longer apply. So what happened?
Basically, a slow political movement that by now had a superstar with Michael. Again, this was the time of AIDS, so society was rallying around the people who were dying all around them. And by the mid-1990s, you had people on TV. We know Ellen DeGeneres, RuPaul, Pedro Zamora. I remember the first time I saw a young gay teen on television, it was Ryan Philippe. I think it might have been on One Life to Live or something, and I would, put the tape in the VCR to tape the soap opera every day while I was on high school because I wanted to figure out what was happening to this gay character. But, you had this societal change that by the 1990s leads to legal change. And not forget, it's marching, it's organizations, it's all this type of thing. And so by 1998, here in Georgia, we get a state case called Powell versus Georgia, which was a heterosexual case, by the way, that overturned Georgia's sodomy law here in Georgia. Mm-hmm. As you may know from recent news, Georgia has a little bit stronger privacy protections in its state constitution than the federal constitution does. So we get the state sodomy laws overturned in 1998 and federally in 2003. But sadly, Michael would not live to see these victories.
Well, when did he die?
He died in 1991 in Gainesville, Florida, of AIDS. So basically, every bad thing that could happen to you in the 1980s to a gay man happened to this guy. Died of AIDS in 1991. Very sad towards the end.
Well, tell us, what gives this book the narrative edge?
Well, probably seeing by the expressions on my face, I get most lit up when I'm talking about sort of his life and his private life.
It seems like you like this guy just as a person.
I mean, I have known so many gay men like Michael, good looking. Maybe they don't have a college education, but they've got a spark within them. And the book goes into his friends and the people that he touched. And so this was about getting to the person behind the name. I mean, we hear the word Plessy v. Ferguson. Who is Plessy?
Right.
We hear Brown versus Board of Education. Who is Brown? And so finally, with this Supreme Court case, Bowers v. Hardwick, we get to know about the Hardwick in the case. Yes, we do get to know about the legal strategy, and I think we probably talked a lot about that here, but this was a fabulous biography. Highly, highly recommend it.
Well, it sounds fascinating. The book is called The Many Passions of Michael Hardwick, Sex and the Supreme Court in the Age of AIDS by Martin Padgett. Orlando, thanks for talking to me about it.
My pleasure.